even if you don't. And the question that I might ally with, do you see yourself ever starting a missionary society? And if not, why not? Is there something so holy and spiritual about such a task that you could never envisage yourself as being that kind of a pioneer? Well, we've come to put your minds at ease on that issue today, because many of you know many of us, the trustees of the India Ministries Fellowship, and you know that not only are we not entirely holy, we aren't even yet ready for beatification. So, saintliness is not the sine qua non of working in partnership with Christians overseas, but there are some ingredients which may help. If I were to tell you of how the little ministry called the India Ministries Fellowship got up and running, it might dispel some myths as to how a work may be born, and we hope that some of you might catch something of a vision of God's work in the world and your part in it. It started something like this. A postgraduate student came in the early 1980s to study in Aberdeen University with Professor Andrew Walls. He came from South India, not Professor Walls, the overseas student. His name is Mr. Arliss. He had seen a huge need in his native land, as the streets are filled with penniless beggars, orphans, bonded servants, the modern word for slaves. And he had seen at the same time one or two good models in southern India of caring for some of the poorest children within a Christian environment. And God enlarged Mr. Arliss's heart to want to help some of the poorest of the poor. So, when he came to Aberdeen, he called together half a dozen of us, final year divinity students, and he laid before us something of the vast need in that great continent, second largest population in the world. But he also shared with us a little of his vision about what a few of us could do to help a few children out in India. Now, the six of us who were there were impressed at what we heard. Our hearts were moved. Now, few of us had any money, Malcolm aside, obviously. We were students, you see. But we did decide that, poor as we were, we could covenant, say, £200 each per annum to start a work with some of those poverty-trap youngsters. And so it was in May 1984 that we started what we were later to call the India Ministries Fellowship. The initials IMF are well known throughout the world for other reasons. You may say two extremes: the International Monetary Fund with its billions, and our IMF with £1,200 a year. Yet that £1,200 or thereby was sufficient to employ a couple, a Christian couple, to look after 12 boys in rented accommodation each year. The house parents were relatives of Mr. Arliss. The boys were chosen largely by those leaders of the Church of South India, and the boys themselves came from Christian, Hindu, Sikh backgrounds. And some of them were orphans. Some of them had parents who had too many children to look after. All of them came from very poor backgrounds. Some of them, their parents were alcoholics. Some of them, their parents, maybe they only had one parent, was a bonded servant with an annual salary of something like a sack of rice. It sounds like the feudal days in Scotland, only it was a sack of oats here. Sack of rice, what would you do with that? How would you feed your family? Well, very difficult is the answer. And so that was the backgrounds from which our boys were and are taken. Now, you might ask, what good is it helping 12 boys? It's a drop in the ocean. It's maybe worse than doing nothing, especially if you take 12 boys out of their homes, bring them into a commodious, plush environment. It could be worse, where they're favoured above their peers. However, our boys had no great luxuries. They slept and sleep on a floor. But they are encouraged in their schoolwork. There's nothing fancy, but they are surrounded by the love of Jesus. Within a very short time, our lads had gone from some of the lowest academically in school to some of the best students in school. Their grades went up and up. There was no pressure on them now, you see, to leave school age 9, 10, 11, to start working, to provide money for their poor families. They were at school and happy to be there. The house father was a school teacher and he encouraged them in their schoolwork. And there was a routine of physical and spiritual exercise that meant that the lads could grow in every way. After 1 year of renting accommodation, we decided to buy a plot of land and build a little place of our own. It wasn't much, just a mud hut, thatched roof, but it has become home to quite a number of boys over these last 15 years. Now, if you had gone to visit those lads, it would just have melted your heart. There they were, sleeping side by side on the floor on raffia mats, with a small box against the wall at their heads, perhaps, or at their feet, containing their total worldly possessions. A school uniform, maybe a scout uniform, and some school books. And you would ask, were those boys happy? Living with such meagre resources, now separated from their parents, if they had any, during the school year? Were they happy? The answer is yes. They were, and they are, happy boys. Worldly possessions mean very little to the majority of the lads. They are so pleased to be in a loving and caring environment. And when we visit, as trustees, they will sing songs to us. They will perform musical and comical sketches for us. They will pray with us. And perhaps most movingly of all, they will pray for us. It really is a humbling experience to hear your name, the only words you can pick out from a Tamil prayer, a whole lot of Tamil words, and then you hear your name mentioned, knowing that a little mite is thanking God for you and praying for God to look after you. The house parents devoted themselves to those 12 and then 30, then 50, now 60 boys. They rarely took a holiday. They just cared for the young lads who were their charges. Now, here is something that you don't hear from many of the missionary societies. But we believe that this is probably much more rife than you might imagine. We Scottish trustees, of course, were very careful with money, as Scottish people are. Every penny which came in for the India Ministries Fellowship went straight out to India. None of our funds went on advertising. None of our funds went on printing and postage. That's always been taken care of in-house amongst the trustees. We received from India meticulous accounts of almost every grain of rice that was bought and sold and used. Then something happened. To this day, we don't know how it came to pass. But the background to it is something like this. In order to transfer funds easily into India, a society has to register for an FCRA number. That is a foreign currency registration account number. It's a simple administrative piece of machinery which enables the Indian government to have an idea of how much money is coming into the country via charitable agencies. If we had been prepared as an organization on day one to give a small bribe to the clerk in the office, we would have had this FCRA number in a matter of days. However, we felt that it was important to act honourably and to refuse to bribe the officials. So that very small piece of administrative paperwork took 7 years to complete, along with many local representations to local government offices. Because we didn't have that official recognition in the early years, we simply registered the land and the property in the name of the house parents. It seemed the sensible thing to do. Well, a couple of years ago, trouble brewed in this boy's home in Terutani. The house father started claiming that the property and the land and the title deeds were rightfully his. He refused to hand over the title deeds of the property. He claimed that the IMF was his brainchild, his organization. Now, you might be utterly shocked by this. And I have to say that we trustees who had worked so hard for so many years, initially we were pretty shocked too. However, as time has gone on, we've begun to realize that this is simply part of the disease of corruption which involves every area of Indian life, even church life. It's easy for us to sit on the touchlines and condemn. Far more difficult for Christians out there to sort out what is and what isn't corruption. We hope, 2 years on, that this matter is now almost resolved. But again, it takes a long time for these things to filter through the legal system in South India. And again, you might be asking yourselves, can 12 boys, or even what we have now, some 200 plus boys and girls, Graham's going to say a wee bit about that just now, can that number really do anything in a country of some 800 million souls? In answer to that, we would say that it only takes a little salt to flavour society, a little leaven to leaven the whole lump. India is a land cursed with institutional corruption and a religion that keeps people chained into a caste system. Graham will say more about that. But we look for and we pray for changes. Maybe some of our youngsters, or one of them, will be a Christian Gandhi one day. You see, the alternative to doing something little is doing nothing. And we reckon that the little is the only option that's open to us. Graham.
It's always been so refreshing to come here first thing in the new year, and so restful, till I got roped into doing this. Spoiled it completely for me. Now, can I ask anybody who came in, if there's anybody here who didn't get a number, anybody who wasn't given a number when you came in, could you stand up, please, just so I can check you out here? Have you get, please? Yes? These folk who came in late. Oh, you haven't got numbers either, right? Right. Now, you're number 9 and 10, and Mr. Scott, you're number 1. Okay, you'll be number 4, and number you'll be a 10 as well, and a 14, and over here a 20 and a 19. Okay, that'll do us. Ah, there's plenty of 20s. It's okay. Good. Right. You said that we are not near to beatification, we are not particularly saintly, and not very well qualified to be founders of a missionary organisation. I wasn't in there in the beginning, by the way. I was one of these people who supported India Ministries Fellowship, and then after a while I got roped in as a trustee, and now I seem to be up to my neck in it at this very moment. I'm terribly unqualified ever to have anything to do with missionaries, apart from maybe support them and pray for them. I'll never be suited to be a missionary, and there's a very good reason for that. You see, I cannot abide creepy crawlies. I went to India and I woke up with cockroaches round about me, a cockroach inside my pyjamas. Now, this was just too much for me, and I've decided that the home field is where my vocation lies, and all the crosses that go with it. But I have got kind of involved, and I want to tell you a little bit about what I've learned as I've been involved. What's the first thing you think about when you think of India? Any ideas? You want to stick their hand up and give me an answer? Tea. You would. Tea. Poverty. There's a lot of it. Cows. Right. Cows to you too, sir. Right. Who was that? Cows, yes, they're everywhere. They're wandering about the roads up and down the central reservation, in and out of houses, anywhere they like. Cows. What else have we got? What's that? Masses of people. They're everywhere. Actually, India's not as densely populated as Britain. It's such a big place, you see. There are vast empty areas. But it's when you go to the cities, there are crowds and crowds of people. What else do you think of when you think of India? Curry. That's a hot answer. Anything else? Muslim people. There's quite a lot of them, isn't there? There's about 10% of the population of India are Muslim. Hindu people. Right? The caste system. I'm glad somebody has mentioned the caste system. Right? Nothing to do with breaking your ankle and or anything like that and landing up and getting plastered. The caste system. Now, this is where we're going to do something that's a bit uncreefish. We're going to do a little exercise to demonstrate the caste system to you. I hope you all remember the number you've been given, because I'm going to tell you what you've got to do. If you've got number 20, I want you to come out and stand at the front here. Number 20. If you've got number 1 to 3, could you take your shoes off, please? Okay? 1 to 3, take your shoes off. Right? If you're 20, come out the front here now. Come on, there are some 20s. Come on. If you've got number 14 to 19, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, breathe a big sigh of relief and stay firmly on your seat. You don't have to move. These are the 20s. Good lads, out you come. If you've got 8 to 13, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, stand up. Right, come out round behind here, that's right. There we go. So we've got some people standing, we've got some people sitting. Now, 1 to 3s, have you got your socks off? You've got your shoes off. Right, now I want you to stand on your chair. We have official permission from the hotel to do this. If you've 1 to 3, stand on your chair, that's it. Very good, very good. Now, who does that leave? That leaves 4 to 7. 4, 5, 6 and 7. If you're 4, 5, 6 and 7, I want you to kneel on the floor. Some members of the... Oh, they're all... You see, you can't even see them. If you're sitting quite far back there and you're kneeling on the floor, would you like to come out the front and kneel? That would be an even better idea. No, you're not to be seen kneeling. That's very pious of you. Very good. Now, we've got the 20s out the front here. We've got these gentlemen. These are the Brahmins here. This is the Brahmin caste in Indian society. You can see that they make up a fairly small proportion. They are the people at the top of the social heap. And they're well chosen. The caste system, of course, maintains their place in society. They don't necessarily have the most important jobs, but they are the people that others would look to for advice on what's ethically right or wrong. And the caste system gave them enormous power in previous days, of course, to keep other people in their place. Nobody's terribly sure whether Hinduism came first or the caste system came first. One may have bolstered the other. They're both very, 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 very ancient. So we've got the Brahmins here at the top of the pile. I didn't know how we could elevate you in any higher way other than bringing you out to this distinguished dais at the front here. If you're standing on a chair, looking very, very distinguished, then you're the military class or the administrative class. The administrators and the army people, you're very important people in the society. You're a fair chunk, as you can see. A bit less than a fifth. Then if you're sitting down, you're in the... Well, no, you're standing up, some of you. If you're standing, not quite as high as the administrators. If you're standing up, we've got the commercial classes, a commercial band of castes. And if you're sitting down, you're in the agricultural castes. You're the farmers who do the work on the land, and you make up, those of you who are sitting down, you make up a fair chunk of Indian society. Right? Now, I'm keeping the caste system as simple as possible. You'll realize I've only mentioned four. We've got the Brahmins, we've got the folk that are the high Hedians, and we've got the standing up folk, and we've got the sitting down folk. Four levels. There are actually more than 4,000, but you realise that was a bit difficult to demonstrate in this this short time that we've got. 4,000 is not as many as there are gods in Hinduism, but it's a lot of castes. And everybody knows their place. You remember that sketch in the 1960s with John Cleese and Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett? You know, I'm upper class, and I look down on him, and I'm lower class, and I know my place. Well, everybody in India knows their place, whichever one of the castes they fit into. But of course, there's a group of people we haven't even mentioned yet. They're kneeling on the floor, looking ever so pious, here, there, and roundabout. You can see there's a fair chunk of them. In fact, they represent about a fifth of the group here. And they don't have any caste at all. They just hobble. They're the outcasts, or the untouchables. Gandhi, of course, sought to integrate them into society. I bet he gave them a name, which I can't remember, but Malcolm will know immediately. The children of God. This name has been banned in certain areas of India because it's not PC. The name they tend to call themselves is the Dalits, which means the oppressed peoples. Is that right? No, something like that. So we've got the Dalits, who are at the very bottom of the pile. If there's somebody cleaning out your toilet or somebody sweeping the streets, they're going to be one of the Dalits, the untouchable class. Right, you can sit down again, everybody. Thanks very much. And for the sake of the rest of us, put your shoes on. You maybe get a little bit of a flavour of this society where everybody knows their place and everything is levelled into the caste system. But we've mentioned these people who have no caste at all, the untouchables. All of this system, of course, is allied to Hinduism, in which your place in society is the result of your karma. You are what you are because of what has been decreed for you, because of your past life, and you've got to accept it. And if you're one of the untouchables, if you're an outcast, well, that's what your karma has given to you, and nobody has the right to raise you out of that. In fact, if somebody comes along and raises you out of that and is kind to you, then that's not very good for you, because you're jolly well going to have to be reincarnated back in as an untouchable again, as an outcast, so that you can go through your karma properly. And if I've been reincarnated as somebody who's at the top of the heap, well, that's my privilege, and I can use it or abuse it as I please. I'll use the power I've got, and you have no right to expect me to be kind to you or to lift you out of the state you're in. Quite the opposite. I must leave you in the state in which you have been born. And it's important for us to understand all that. Does that explain? I'm not sure if it does, but is that part of the reason why corruption is so endemic in India and nobody will do anything about it, or everybody winks at it? Because people use the opportunities that their karma has given them and the position of privilege they have to use or abuse. Anyway, what we've been seeking to do with India Ministries Fellowship is to work with some of these people who are the untouchables, the Dalits, the people at the very bottom of the heap. And let me say something else about them, as if the picture of them wasn't bad enough. There is, of course, government relief for the Dalits, the untouchables. They get help with their education. They get some government assistance. But if you're a Christian, or a Muslim for that matter, then you don't have a caste. You're not even an outcast. So if you're poor, if by birth you are an outcast, if you're Indian, born into one of the Dalit groups, but you're a Christian, then you don't fit into the system. No help for you. You're an adherent of a Western religion outside the system. So while there might be government help for the untouchables at the bottom of the pile, no help for you if you're a Christian or a Muslim. So many of the folk that we help, the poorest of the people, come from nominally Christian backgrounds who fall through the net of government help and are among the poorest of the poor. Now you can imagine what it's like to be in that group, to be discriminated against, to be bullied at school. And what if you're a woman? Well, that's even worse, of course, isn't it? With the discrimination against women in Indian society, you're going to be the victim of further prejudice. So what about the girls? Hughes mentioned the boys and the home that was set up, Gracious Jesus Home at Tiruttani for the boys. But what about the girls? India Ministries Fellowship had been going for a couple of years when some folks said, well, you know, what about girls? Is it just boys you care for? And minds went to work to think, what can we do for the girls? But if you're going to do something for girls in Indian society, you will realise there's a problem. You can't just set up a home for girls. You can't just help girls with their education, give them Christian nurture, and then send them out to contribute to society the way you hope the boys will. Why not? Marriage? Well, that's nice for them, but what about marriage? You'd have to arrange it, and what else would you have to do? You'd have to pay for it, wouldn't you? Provide the dowries, okay? Well, being Aberdonian, we couldn't possibly provide the dowries, and we came up with another solution. The solution is what we would call educational assistance programs, and we've been able to give help to girls through an educational assistance program. We have two of them in two different centres. One is in the town of Kolar Goldfields. If you can imagine the town of Kolar Goldfields, it's got some of the deepest mine shafts in the world. There's only one in South Africa that's deeper than the mine shaft in Kolar Goldfields. It gets its name, as you'll realise, from the mining of gold. In the last century, thousands of people worked there, but now only a few hundred. Price of gold has gone down. India can't compete. Unemployment. And in Kolar Goldfields, India Ministries Fellowship is giving help to girls. Financial help to provide for school books, uniforms, clothes, some additional tuition for their school work, regular medical checkups by volunteers with health qualification from the local church. Most importantly, Christian fellowship. The opportunity to meet together, to worship, to study the Bible together, to go to occasional camps together. And these girls have found fellowship and companionship, encouragement with one another. These girls who were the bottom of the social heap have found that they have the right, through faith in Jesus Christ, to be called children of God. And they have found esteem and brotherhood, sisterhood with one another. We've got a similar project in, I never pronounce this place properly, Madavaram. Madavaram is an area of what you used to call Madras. It's now called Chennai, or something like that. Madavaram's a slum area in Madras. That means houses are pretty shoddily put together. There's no water supply. There's no sanitation. But from this area came a fine Christian couple that we have a partnership with. Gentleman by the name of John Wesley, Reverend John Wesley, who grew up in the area and ministered in the Church of South India in the area and is highly respected there. And his wife, Vimala, who's known door to door around Madavaram and respected for her care and compassion for people there. And we do a similar project in Madavaram with boys and girls in what we call an educational assistance program. Them living in their own homes, but being given financial support, educational support, and particularly Christian nurture. Can I just say a word about some of our partner Christians and a word about the impact on the kids? I have to say that we have established a partnership with Christians in India. You will realize that this is not a conventional missionary organization in the sense that we are sending people or going out from Britain. All we are doing is gathering money and, more important, praying and supporting people. It's our partners on the ground in India who are doing the work, who've said, look, this is what we could do if you support us. So they make the important decisions. But they are people of great devotion who draw our admiration. I have to say they draw our frustration too. At times it's difficult to get information about what's going on. Sometimes they want to do far more than we can afford to do. We want them to send us photographs of the kids, and they line them up as if they're facing a firing squad. And we try to get testimonies from the kids, but the information's slow in coming. So sometimes we get frustrated with our friends in India. But we admire them. We admire them for their devotion. In Kola Goldfields and in Madavaram, the projects are overseen by committees of local Christians. And these local Christians have opened their homes to be used for the work. I can think of Mr. Samuel, the tailor in Kola Goldfields, who used his living room to store all the files on the girls in Kola Goldfields, to interview them and meet with them and their parents, and for the committee to meet there and make hard decisions about who to help and who not to help. Now we have a building which we've been able to provide where interviews can be carried out and where the girls can meet together and where hospitality can be provided. But these Christian folk have given their energy, their homes and their lives to helping some of the poorest folk in their community. They have a vision that these girls and boys can be given skills, dressmaking, tailoring, typing skills. In Madavaram, the committee wanted to purchase a building. We said, no, we can't afford it. They said, well, we'll put up £1,000 and we'll purchase the building and the money will come, and the money is coming. They managed to raise some money locally and they're using that building. They use it as an eye clinic for local people. They've been holding regular meetings with elderly people and, again, teaching the young people useful skills. I want to mention my admiration for Mrs. Nalini Arliss. We mentioned Dr. Arliss, who really got the thing up and running. Nalini Arliss is a woman of enormous energy, and we're glad to be partnered with her. When one boy who came from the home, he came to the city of Bangalore, and he got hit by a vehicle on the road and was seriously injured. When Murthy was in danger of losing his leg, Dr. Arliss, she's a doctor of theology, took him round hospitals, argued with surgeons, to find hospital to hospital, till she found someone who would treat him and wouldn't amputate his leg. She took the risk that she made decisions to get him the right treatment, so determined was she. She's had to wrestle with tradesmen, and it's difficult to get good tradesmen in India, ask the Duke of Edinburgh. She's had to argue with tradesmen to see that work was done right, to determinedly see that the renovation of buildings was done properly, and we didn't get taken advantage of. And as you've heard already, that's so easy. And when our house parent in Tirutani said, I'm keeping the title deeds and you're only getting them if I get money for them, she said, we'll spend our savings. We'll hand over our savings. Because, and she was sitting in my living room when she said this, mission is costly and risky. And we are committed to these children, and we're committed to you, our partners in Scotland. And Nalini Arliss gives me the impression, and you'd expect this of a Christian, wouldn't you? Nalini Arliss gives me the impression that there really isn't anything worth living for except Christ and his kingdom and the impact that that's making on young people. So we have admiration for our partners. The kids, well, they're flourishing in one degree or another. I couldn't get much out of the girls when I met them because they didn't have much English. All I could get out was, where is Uncle Malcolm? But they sung and they danced. We don't talk about dance much in Crieff, I know, but they danced and they acted and performed Christian sketches. They read the Bible. This one 14-year-old boy took his Bible in his hand and he stood there for a quarter of an hour and led the evening's devotions. And all the other boys flicked through the passages in the Bible and listened intently. Can you imagine that? 14-year-old in a youth fellowship or something in Scotland. And as Hugh said, to hear them pray, and the memory that sticks with me, to hear them sing the Lord's praise was uplifting. I'm going to leave you with a passage from the Bible that really has come alive for me through my experience of meeting these kids in India. As they came up to me and said, when you come back, Uncle? Well, no rupees. I'm back when I've got rupees. And greeted me as if I was some kind of long-lost relative, which I suppose I am. Jesus told a story that you probably scratch your heads over sometime or other, about a man who was shrewd. He worked the system. He had given a false account of his work. And he was told he was going to get the sack. Hand in your accounts, said the boss. So you know what the shrewd man did. He went round and he altered everybody's accounts so that he had pals. And so that when he lost his job, he'd be able to go to them and he'd be in their favour. He'd be their friend. Jesus said, look, if the wise folk of this world know how to use their money to get friends, you Christians, you should have a much better idea how to use unrighteous money. What did Jesus say? Make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal habitations. Life expectancy being what it is, some of these young folk will beat me to glory. And when they get there, we're going to meet again. And they'll be there to welcome me and you who've invested in them. And there'll be all the other folk who you invested your life in that nobody else knew about. There'll be the old buddies who wasted away with dementia in the Church of Scotland home and said, aye, you were a supporter of the Board of Social Responsibility. You blessed me. And they'll be there. And all the people in distant parts of the world that we have invested in and never met, they will be there to welcome us into eternal habitations. Hugh said it's not very many. It's just a wee mustard seed from which the kingdom is grown. But it's worth investing every penny that we can in these folk whom we will meet and share eternity with. Thank you. Now I'll hand you over to the chairman of the trustees in Scotland, to whom you will accord the proper honour. This is the Reverend Thomas Malcolm Fullerton Duff, known to us as Uncle Malcolm. The best question.
I'm just going to ignore that. Can I say that we have some copies of not the most recent publicity, but this is an account of a visit by somebody that I've never met, who belongs to Westerton Church in Bear's Den, a chap called Ewan Miller, who was out in South India as part of his legal training. And one of my own congregation said, why don't you photocopy that and give it to the men at Crieff? Because it's a very good picture of life in the boys' home. My job is to try and sum things up and reflect a little on this work that we've been involved in for some 15 years. But how to reflect on that? I remember Mr. Still speaking about how the Crieff Fellowship grew and blossomed, and he said it was like Topsy, it just growed. And IMF's been a bit like that. It began in response to the Macedonian call of Indian brothers and sisters, come over and help us. And that call had, I think, three different forms. First of all, a call to engage in mission. A call to engage in mission in an age in which cross-cultural mission has largely been forgotten by the mainline churches, and has been undermined in theology, and most cross-cultural mission has been left to the independent missionary societies. It was secondly a call to share in mission with Christian brothers and sisters in India. Yes, there are churches in India. There are missionary societies in India sending missionaries all over India. In fact, there may be more missionaries sent by Indian churches than any other country apart from Korea. But the establishment of churches and the difficulty of foreigners getting visas doesn't abrogate the Great Commission. Jesus still says, go into the world and make disciples of all nations. And it was a call to share with Indian Christians in the mission that they took very, very seriously. And thirdly, and very significantly for us in Scotland, it was a challenge to come and learn about mission. Because we live at a time when the Western churches are struggling to communicate the gospel. We are facing the challenge of pluralism that Dr. Packer referred to this morning. And I want to suggest that involvement in mission, with particularly with Indians, because that's our experience, can be a great help in helping us to face the challenge of mission in contemporary Scotland. Now, these very areas of concern could be reasons not to do mission. We live in a pluralistic society, and many will say that around the world the real need is social and material. Although again and again, in my involvement with the Bible Society, we hear that wherever there are problems in the world, it is the Word of God that people appreciate. It is the Scriptures that bring hope. So, the pluralistic society. Secondly, people will say we live in a post-mission age in which the churches are already established around the world. But there are many parts of the world where there are no churches, where there are no Christians. Who's going to go to them? And thirdly, and I think this is one that we all feel, what have we got to offer? We can't communicate with our own society. What right have we got to tell other people what to believe? I would face that question at selection school. I won't tell you who asked it to me. I'd like to think he was playing devil's advocate, but I'm not really quite sure. He said that God spoke to him through his dog. That might give you a clue. But he said to me, I'd come back from 2 years working with the churches in Kenya, and he said to me, don't you think it was very arrogant for us in Scotland to send missionaries out to Africa to tell people to believe in our God when they were quite happy with their own religions? Well, I didn't rise to that bait. I just said to him, well, I think you should ask African Christians, and they would be very angry and hurt at you suggesting that they didn't need the gospel. Mission doesn't wait for fertile ground. Mission doesn't stop when some churches have been planted. Mission doesn't wait until we've got a finished product to market and a successful message. It's directed to the one sheep that's lost out of 100. It sows on stony ground and among weeds, as well as on good soil. It's God who gives the increase. And I want to spend a little time with you this afternoon having a look at the book of Ruth. Because Ruth is a profoundly missionary book. It tells a story of how God brought the Moabitess Ruth into the kingdom of God, into the family of Israel, into the lineage of David and of the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's a book that I think has a lot to say to us today about mission, and I want to suggest it can help us to understand our work in IMF. And what I want to do is give you headings and read short passages and then comment briefly on them for you. IMF has, I want to suggest, five different areas in its missionary concern and motivation. And the first is what we have heard from Graham, particularly, a concern for the needy. And if we read the first five verses of the book of Ruth, we read that it was in the days when the judges ruled, and there was a famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. That's a very good description of many a third world landless laborer. It's a very powerful picture of someone who has lost loved ones through a disease like cholera, a woman who is powerless in society and very much open to being taken advantage of. And we take for granted that we have a responsibility to care for the poor and for the needy. I don't want to go into the arguments about who are the poor in Scripture. But we know that our own hearts are drawn towards those in desperate physical need. Spurgeon once said that if you want to give a hungry man a tract, make sure you wrap it in a sandwich. And IMF is involved in holistic mission. We don't just feed bodies, but we care for the whole man. And that's what the book of Ruth ultimately does. It recognizes this woman, Ruth, as well as her mother-in-law, Naomi. It brings her into the family of God. It cares for her. And she's provided ultimately with a husband. But there's a desperate condition there. Care for the needy. The second heading that grows out of the book of Ruth is compassion for the individual. And we see this later on in chapter 1, where Naomi is trying to ask her daughter-in-laws to go back to Moab. And Naomi says, "Your sister-in-law is going back," in verse 15, "to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." Individuals matter to God. It's one thing to love the world. It's one thing to give some money to help poverty. And I think as ministers, if your congregation is anything like mine, people want to give to the urgent, desperate needs that we see on our television screens. It's hard to get people to think beyond that. But the Bible is concerned about individuals. And the book of Ruth is set in the day of the judges, when individuals didn't matter. And yet this book describes these humble people. They're not kings, they're not judges, they're not prophets, they're not priests. They have nobody to look after them. Boaz says, whose woman is this? He's talking about Ruth, who's come to glean in his field. And there is something about Boaz and about the welcome that Ruth received in Israel that is a picture of the God of Israel, under whose wings Ruth took refuge. It's that concern for the individual that I think we can express in our work in IMF. It's not a big work. Our income is something a little over £20,000 a year. But one of the benefits of being small is that we don't become anonymous. We know the names of the children that we care for. And they know us, and they pray for us. And Graham has shown the illustration of the boy Murthy, who fell off his bike, was hit by a lorry, and within a day, Nalini had emailed us to ask for prayer, and within 2 days, she'd persuaded a surgeon to save that leg. You see, mission doesn't stop with just helping to meet the hunger and clothing the naked. It says to people like Ruth or people like Murthy, you matter to God. Jesus said, "If anyone gives even a cup of water to one of those little ones because he is my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will not lose his reward." But we go on from that. Not only a concern for the poor and a compassion for the individual, but a commitment to justice is part of Christian mission as well. The book of Ruth describes how there was in the law of Israel provision for the poor to glean. We see it at the beginning of chapter 2. At verse 2, Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. And as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. there was the provision for the poor. It wasn't a very glamorous thing. I'm sure it was a very humbling and embarrassing thing to have to go behind the harvesters and pick up what was left over. But at least in Israel, there was that provision for the poor. In India, there's nothing like that. In fact, the structures combine to oppress the poor. And the book of Ruth is set in the days of the judges when there was a lot of injustice. If you turn back to the end of the book of Judges, you'll see that from in Bethlehem itself, there was a man, a Levite, who threw his concubine into the street to be gang-raped in Gibeah, and who then called the tribes to avenge her. That was the world that the book of Ruth was set in. A corrupt, violent world. And even the leaders of God's people were no better. And if we get involved in Christian mission, at here or in India, we will face the powers of darkness. And so, we're going to face injustice. Graham spoke of the law of karma, which Glenn Hoddle and many others in the West follow, apparently. And if people believe in reincarnation and the law of karma, then there's no incentive to help the poor, because helping them could actually be wrong. And in our own history, in the history of India, it has been Christians, again and again, who have challenged injustice, who have enabled inhuman practices to be outlawed. In fact, missions were not the idea of the British government. And the East India Society, which ruled British India for many years, actually banned missionaries and opposed the education of Indians. William Carey wasn't allowed to land in British territory in 1792, and so he went to the Danish enclave of Serampore upriver from Calcutta. And sati, the burning of widows, was only seen to be wrong by Hindus when Alexander Duff of Pitlochry persuaded the Hindu Ramohan Roy of its inherent evil. Again and again, it's Christian influence that has challenged injustice in India. I was reading a book of Vinod Ramachandra from Sri Lanka, whose books are very, very helpful on many of the issues of pluralism and so on. And he was pointing out that in 1944, I think it was, something like 95% of nurses in India were Christians. Why? Because it would pollute a Hindu to touch a dead or a sick body. Christian health care has been at the heart of medicine in India. And the two best hospitals in India, if not in South Asia, are Christian Medical College in Ludhiana and Christian Medical College in Vellore in South India. So Christian mission has done a tremendous amount to bring hope and to bring some justice to the poor in India. And it's this kind of thing that the Hindu fundamentalist movement is reacting against. And many Christians have been martyred in the last few years, including Australian missionary Graham Staines and his family. They want to turn the clock back to a pre-modern era and restore what they think is pure Hinduism, which probably wasn't, but anyway, that's what they want. No, you have to face corruption, the temptations for bribery. But when Ruth joined the people of Israel, she made a clear commitment. Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. She left her hopes of a husband behind, because she trusted in God. Commitment to justice. Then fourthly, the challenge to the church. And in chapter 3, we find Ruth herself taking up this challenge and taking the provision of God's law for a Levirate marriage, and she says that she wants to go to Boaz. And Naomi encourages her and says, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself, put on your best clothes, then go down to the threshing floor. but don't let him know you are there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. And later on, of course, she did that, and he woke up, and she said, spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. She challenged Boaz to take his responsibilities as a goel, as a kinsman redeemer, seriously. And that's one of the exciting things about this girl, Ruth. She just doesn't sit and wait for things to happen. She takes the initiative. Even if she hadn't married Boaz, her life would have spoken powerfully to the people of Bethlehem. They were the people of God. But it was through the life of this foreigner that they most clearly saw the love of God. They needed to be reminded that they were God's children by grace, and that they had a commitment to show that grace to others. And I think that's something that we've found in IMF. It's been a blessing to give, but it's been even more of a blessing to receive. And those of you who've been involved in mission in different parts of the world will know the thrill of receiving from others who have shared in ministry with you. And I wonder if that's a challenge that we as a church in the West, and we perhaps as a Creef Fellowship, need to hear. This year I took two people out to India, and they could tell you what they learned from that. But you could come yourself. There are plenty of opportunities for ministers to help pastors in India to expound the scriptures. David Burgess, I once met in Delhi, and he has since been to Nepal and to other countries, including Brazil, to form partnerships like that. Gordon Files and others also have been abroad. David Searle and David Johnston here also. I want to suggest that perhaps as a Creef Fellowship, we should not be simply regarding these as individuals who go abroad, but trying to encourage one another and trying to use the gifts that God has given us here to share with those who would like to receive from us. I could develop that a little, but I want to finish with the last point. And that is that Christian mission, at least in the book of Ruth, and I think in its truest sense, is caught up with cooperation in God's purposes. Now, the key to the book of Ruth is the last paragraph, or the last number of verses, where Boaz got married to Ruth. She became his wife. She conceived and gave birth to a son. And that son, of course, was called Obed. And at the end of the book, we read, Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nashon. Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David. The book of Ruth has its purpose in Scripture because it is related to the coming of King David. And our lives and our mission only make sense when we are caught up with the purposes of Christ. That's what makes an anonymous person like Ruth so important. She's nobody special, but she was caught up in God's purposes. And furthermore, we as Christians are caught up not only in being focused on Christ, and that is surely what gives our ministry meaning and direction, however difficult it is, whether it's in Lockwood in Easter House with the empty pews, or whether it's somewhere else. But Christian mission looks to the future. Christian mission looks to the return of Christ. Christian mission hastens the coming of Christ, as Peter said in his second letter. The gospel will be preached to the ends of the earth, and then the end will come. That's a very powerful motive for cross-cultural mission. We are caught up in God's purposes. Now, I want to conclude by saying a few things in conclusion. What I want to say is this. You've heard something of IMF, and if you've got time and you're not fast asleep already, we invite you to stay and watch some slides. But I hope you won't stay and say, well, that's a nice little project these lads are involved in. The real work is the church, and mission is something else, because that's not the way the Bible sees mission. Mission is at the heart of church life. And we give thanks to God for those who have preserved a vision for cross-cultural mission in our churches in this century. But I'm sure the interdenominational missions, and I see some of their representatives here, would want to echo that mission is at the heart of the church. We shouldn't be leaving mission to societies. We need to be finding new ways for the church to send missionaries. Mission is mainstream Christianity. And where churches give and pray for and engage in cross-cultural mission, that's where there's a biblical church. It's interesting in the New Testament that as far as mission was concerned, the Jerusalem church wasn't interested. It was inward looking. It looked to the traditions of the past. And so it was Antioch that became the church that was a pioneer missionary sending church. And where churches take mission seriously, God, I believe, blesses that church. Well, how are we going to do that? I mentioned how there can be many opportunities for ministers to visit India. I'm going out, God willing, in November to speak in a conference at Delhi Bible Institute where Isaac Shaw is director. Isaac was here twice, 2 years ago and 3 years ago, and the bonds there are very deep. In England, out of Proclamation Trust, a thing called Project Timothy grew. And I wonder if perhaps we could do something similar in Scotland involving men like ourselves. I'd like to hear if you're interested in that. It's not IMF. We're not concerned about any particular mission. We're concerned to work together for God's work. And it may be if you're able to stay after the sharing tonight. I know there are many who have been overseas that we might meet together and at least know who is interested in forming such a body. So thank you for listening. Thank you for listening seriously. We appreciate your interest, especially those whose churches and others have prayed for us over the years. Thank you, Sandy, for asking us to speak. It's been a privilege. And in some ways, I think we're quite glad that it was the faithful few rather than the vast multitude that we had this morning. So thank you very much.